hip little capitalists. If you try to take over our space, we're going to burn you all down to the ground.
The most movies you could watch in a day was 6. And this is if you started at 9 a.m. and watched continuously through the midnight movie.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. I'm Jessica Henkin, and with me today is Aaron Henkin, my husband.
Husband Aaron, Stoop co-host and sidekick.
Cute, isn't it?
It's so lovely.
Cute. I
enjoy spending this time. When we do the shows together, it's like a date night.
Yeah.
This is like a little Sunday brunch for us.
Aw, except without food.
Without
I'm very hungry.
Well, that'll keep you motivated
That's
to
true.
Tell us what's happening on this podcast.
If I had had a big breakfast, I'd be sleepy.
What's our theme for this episode?
The bookworm and the cinephile.
Say more about that.
Two stories about people who see the world through pages and screens. We know both of these gentlemen. They are such great, nerdy, wonderful gentlemen. So which one is the cinephile and which is the bookworm?
Well, we'll start with the bookworm,
yes.
Shall we?
Yes.
This bookworm is very near and dear to my heart. Rupert Wondolowski. Some of you may know him from behind the counter at Normal's Books and Records. Others may recognize his voice from way back in the day on WYPR when he used to recite his strange and surreal poetry on the airwaves on the radio program The Signal. He is a friend to Baltimore weirdos.
Oh, yeah.
Coming up on generations now, and just a multifaceted talent in his own right, a musician, and of course, a writer and a poet. And a real dyed-in-the-wool bookworm. A bookworm's bookworm. So here's Rupert on stage at the Stoop.
Hello, thank you. And I apologize if I didn't buy any of your books or records that you may have brought in. And congratulations to Jessica and Laura for 20 years of Stoop. I have an especially fond feeling for Stoop because my first date with my now wife, Everly, was at a Stoop. And I was all excited, you know, to introduce Everly to Jessica because, you know, Jessica and Aaron would always say, well, that Rupert, he's not too bad of a guy, but he's never going to find love. There's no way. And so I went to introduce Jessica to Everly, and right when I'd say, and here is Everly, Everly had turned her back on us and was leaning over a table so that her butt was kind of very prominent. And Jessica said, well, I like what I'm seeing so far. So never forget that. So there have been thousands of great bookstores and interesting bookstores throughout history, some of them very remarkable, like Shakespeare and Company in Paris, where James Joyce, Gertrude Stein, and Hemingway used to hang out. They published James Joyce's Ulysses for the first time, and created a big scandal and almost went out of business from it. And a really cool story that happened there at the end of World War II, Hemingway returned to visit Sylvia Beach, and there were some stray Nazis terrorizing the neighborhood, and Hemingway climbed to the top of the roof and took them out. So, and that is a true story. And then we got like City Lights, co-founded by legendary poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti Getty. Home of the West Coast Beats, meeting place for so many political activities and groups. And in their first year, they had a deal where if you bought $10 or more, Allen Ginsberg would run naked down the aisle carrying your purchase. So that was pretty cool. Got to get in my naked Ginsberg jokes. And then in Baltimore, there's legendary Sherman's Books. With Abe Sherman, carried like Black Panther stuff, all the early Grove Press when it was hard to find, magazines from all over the world, and you weren't considered a true regular customer until he bounced you out on your ear a few different times. But Normal's Books and Records was a bookstore that was partially birthed out of a schizophrenic test study, and that we had our very own Wilhelm Reich orgone box built to spec, and we housed a very occult, legendary male artist prankster named Blaster Al Ackerman, who looked like Philip K. Dick, and whose words were used in the top 10 hit Hamburger Lady, made by the teen heartthrob group Throbbing Gristle. And Blaster always kind of lived in fear that Genesis was going to pop in and say hi. He loved him from a distance, but was a little scared. But yeah, Normals was founded. We opened June 1st, 1990. So we're coming up on 36 years. Oh. And I had hair when we opened. I have photos. Glenn Burney Fro kind of grew upwards. It was a collective of 9 people, which seems, you know, a little large. But we were all very good friends. We were all artists and writers of some sort. And Baltimore has always been such a collective space. And so we all, you know, we played bands together. Some of us lived together. There was a rather almost grotesque mix and match of lovers going on. Because, you know, it was the 80s, early 90s. And some of us had worked for Second Story Books for a while, which is, you know, really fun job until you got older and you wanted to make sure you had health insurance and that your checks would cash. And so we said, hey, let's open up a bookstore ourselves. And it's wild because another thing was many of us had worked and lived for a while around D.C., and not to diss D.C., but I just feel like we couldn't have done what we did except in Baltimore. It's like we literally pitched in like $150 each. We each had to contribute some of our own book collection, and we just constantly were thrifting and hitting yard sales at first. And we checked out many different neighborhoods, but our friends Terry and Dee Dee had a little vintage clothing shop called Las Locas on 31st Street, and they were really great people. And sadly, they went out of business, but when they did, we said, hey, you know, let's give it a shot. It was a very small space. There's like a hair salon there now, but we figured with the farmer's market, and at that time, there was Sam's Belly Food Co-op, like one of the first food co-ops of the city. There was the 31st Street Women's Bookstore. Around the corner, there was a free People's Health Clinic, which is so hard to imagine now. And so we said, oh, this will be great. And we were all definitely, believe me, left of the dial. We were all anarchists, anarcho-communists, neoists, don't-knowists, Trotskyists, but definitely, you know, not too mainstream and definitely not to the right. But Waverly at that time was so very progressive and in a certain way that a lot of the people there were actually suspicious of us, like, wait, you want to make money? You're business people? You know, they really treated us like we were Kmart or something, you know. Which shocked us, you know. It's like, you know, wow, bookstores, you know, information, knowledge, you know. I always assumed that went along with the left and things, you know. God knows the right, especially now, don't seem too interested in books or science or knowledge or education. But it was true. It was pretty wild. In fact, right across from us was the Communist Party USA.
CIA.
No, sorry. And one time our landlord, who was a very cool guy, but, you know, they weren't using it. It was really good space across the street from our little original spot. And so he said, hey, you know, if they're not going to use it, would you guys want to take over there? And we're like, we don't want to step on any toes, But if they don't want that big space where no one's ever doing anything, we would love that. So then that night on our message machine was a message left. Hey, you hip little capitalists, if you try to take over our space, we're going to burn you all down to the ground. You know, it's like, hey, thanks for reaching out, neighbor. You know, could have walked across the street and had a talk about it, for God's sake. but a big part of when we did it, too, not only to be, you know, blood-sucking capitalist, you know, selling those used books, $4 to $6, woo! You know, rolling up on our bikes. And speaking of duct tape, most of us had duct tape shoes and stuff. But we wanted it to be a sanctuary, you know, because part of the, you know, the way we picked Normals as a name was because literally about 4 of the 9 of us were part of a schizophrenic test study at Shepherd Pratt. And if you were found to not be schizophrenic, you were a normal. So I personally did not take part in that test. I was a little nervous what I would find out at that time, but I think I just drank too much, basically. But so it was partially that, and it was partially because, you know, it was a statement about normal. Like, you know, there is no such thing as normal. It's, you know, this on the spectrum thing. And all of us, you know, have been freaks of one kind or another all our lives. My mom had once tearfully looked at me in the kitchen and said, "You're never going to make it in life." You know, it's like, all right. Chariots of Fire, I can hear the song. You know, so this was our little project, and we felt it organically fit into our, you know, our interests. We, you know, we're all, like I said, writers and musicians. We wanted to have shows. At the time, I had a long-running literary magazine called Shattered Whig Review. Ooh, thank you. Oh, wow. All right. And so I published a lot of the people who shopped at the store and, of course, the co-workers. And then in about our fourth or fifth year, the Red Room started up, which was mainly started by John Burnt, who's still one of the co-owners. We're down to 3 co-owners, but John is one of them, but he started this experimental improv series. And at that time, it's so wild because in the 80s and early 90s, you know, experimental music was really, you might have 5 people show up to it or something, and it was, you know, it was not a lot of people into it. And now I feel like it's almost mainstream in a weird way. Like, not the music isn't mainstream, but it's like every show they have is like packed and it's spreading to other venues and everything. You know, not all just because of the Red Room. I think it's sort of a global phenomenon, but it's been really interesting to watch. And so, a lot of you, and we weathered through, 35 years. We weathered through a lot, and like I said, it has been a sanctuary. It's a great place to be. One of the reasons I love it is, like, to be there, like, now when we're in a authoritarian regime, just to be there and talk to people who I feel like, you know, I like your priorities, you know, love, books, music, education, and, you know, and not everybody's like completely on board with the same, you know, the way they want things to go or, you know, the solutions, but it's just wonderful to talk to people who love culture and appreciate it. You know, like we were, a day that really sticks out in my mind, and one of Baltimore's best sound people, Natasha, was one of the people who came through, was on 9/11. You know, I was working with Blaster, and I was like, we were looking at each other like, what do we do? Do we open up? This is just, everything felt so strange. And Blaster said, yeah, you know, I think we should open up. People are going to want to walk around and talk to other people. And we actually, it was one of the few times we didn't play any music for the first few hours. And I forget if Natasha recommended it or we were playing it when she came in, but Eric Satie was the first thing we put on. And it was like, okay, this this was ease us back into the audio world. But now I know a lot of you, the main thing on your mind is, whatever happened to that orgone box? Well, it was used creatively by, this was when we were in, briefly we had the books across the street in a basement, and we had our records still on the original spot. And one night somebody hid in the orgone box, and then when we closed up, they stole the, like, you know, probably $3 worth of coins we had in the drawer and then broke out instead of breaking in. Oh, very, very imaginative of them. And then a week or two after that, literally the pipes burst in the wall behind the orgone box and just all sorts of satanic things flooded out all over it. So we all became Scientologists. Thank you and good night.
I love so much about that story, but my favorite reveal from that story was the origin of the name Normals.
Right? Who would have known?
Yeah. They were all the non-crazies, theoretically. Yeah. That was Rupert's story told at the Stoops 20th anniversary event, Made with Love and Probably Duct Tape, which was a love letter to Baltimore creative communities overall. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with the cinephile part of this podcast episode.
All right, welcome back to the Stoops Storytelling Podcast. This episode, once again, the theme, the bookworm and the cinephile. We heard from our bookworm, Rupert Wantolowski, and now we're going to hear from a cinephile, a Baltimore cinephile for a long time, and someone who has, like, been part of the movie making and movie renting fabric of this town for decades, Eric Allen Hatch. What do you want to say about Eric, Jessica?
Oh, well, I went to college with Eric, and he was just always so kind and smart and funny. And do you know this? You know the story that this was way before us.
I remember him telling this story before on stage before he told his tale.
Yeah.
And but go ahead and
the story
you've set
was,
it up now. So.
The story was that he asked me if I wanted to come over, and because he had a new machine that he wanted to watch movies on called a DVD player.
Mm-hmm. I've tried that line too.
Well, I can't remember. I must have had a conflict because
You didn't? It never happened?
No, it never happened.
You could have had a completely alternate life.
I know. Well, I truly believe in either that we're in a simulation or like the multiverse theory. And so I think in one version of the multiverse,
You have your own life together.
We have a life together.
Well, I hope you guys are happy.
Well,
you probably go out to the movies all the time, see great shows.
Who do you think you would end up with in the multiverse?
I would also end up with Eric Allen Hatch. I always like a good movie recommendation. We should say, by the way, Eric Allen Hatch is on the team at Baltimore Public Media and WYPR, helping to create, curate, and organize the annual New Next Film Festival as well. And this is kind of his story of sort of where it all began for him and how he became the cinephile that he is. So enjoy.
I do have a job that I've come to find sounds like something a little kid would make up. Like, when I grow up, I'm going to watch movies all day and someone's going to pay me for it. Yeah, like, sure, buddy, that's going to happen for you. But somehow that's the situation I find myself in as an adult. And I've noticed, you know, at cocktail parties or funerals that when I describe to people what I do and they're not in the arts, it usually takes a little explanation. And specifically what I do, as Jessica said, is I'm the director of programming for New Next Film Festival. And that's just a fancy way of saying curator. So basically, yes, I watch and pick movies. And when I tell people that, sometimes they look at me with the same seriousness you would look at somebody who says they like chase Pokemon for a living or along those lines. You know, it's like, doesn't sound like a real thing to some people. But to make them understand what I do, sometimes quantifying it helps. So, for instance, sometimes in a week I'll watch, and maybe you could imagine yourself doing this too, 40 or more hours of movies. But these are not movies you got to pick. These are movies that picked you. They were sent to you out of the void. You have no idea what you're pressing play on, what kind of experience you're going to get. And that's really what a film programmer does. And you kind of start off with your work cut out for yourself. So like this year, last month actually, we opened up our call for entries, which is when filmmakers can start sending you their movies. And the first day we posted on Instagram, hey, you can do it now. And we were sent 50 movies that day. So it's like, you're not going to watch 50 movies in a day, right? You're already in the hole. And by the time all is said and done, I expect I'll have been sent about 1,000 movies in June when I close the call for entries. So, and yes, I do watch every single one of them. I watch them all the way to the end. I take careful notes. You know, it's like, I'm trying to take, you know, it's a fun job, but it's also, I'm a gatekeeper, and I take that seriously. Like, I'm not trying to be nepotistic, and I'm not trying to be lazy about this. I'm trying to take it seriously and realize that these are people's hopes and dreams. But if we go back to when I was a little kid, and this was not a job that I could have dreamed up as a little kid, like actually really impossible for me. I grew up without even a TV in the house. My parents thought it would be good for me for some reason to be reading books or playing outside, things like that. But I quickly found that's not where my interests lie, although I do read a lot, but yeah, I'm not a football guy, for instance. By the time, you know, like, so as a little kid, it didn't matter if it was like Citizen Kane or like Crocodile Dundee 2, you know, it's like equally mesmerizing and transfixing to me. It was all movie magic. And in middle school, when like we're having sleepovers and eating pizza and horror movies, like, this actually contradicts the Jessica story, but, you know, when the other kids are like, oh, maybe we should sneak out and try to talk to girls, I'm like, well, we got a third horror movie here. Like, we should put this in the VCR, you know? It's always been a lifetime of movies, but I got out of college having seen a lot of movies, but not any clear career plan or certainly financial plan. I had developed maybe a little bit of a knack for writing, and so I thought, oh, maybe I should write the great American novel someday. But there wasn't a clear plan to execute that, and I had to pay the bills somehow. So I was kind of drifting from job to job here in Baltimore in the late 90s. And my hangout during this time was Video American. People remember Video American? Okay, yeah. So, yeah, the biggest applause of the night, and deservedly so. If you don't know Video American, it was a special place. You missed out. You can, however, get a sneak peek at it because there's a juicy scene in John Waters' movie Serial Mom shot in Video American. And it's not like a flash. It's like 10 minutes. So it's worth checking out. I do recommend it. But anyway, this is where I was hanging out every night, just like picking the brains of the clerks there, soaking up the history, the film ambiance, and, you know, for a $3 rental, just making sure I spent those $3 wisely and took home the best movie, like reading all the VCR VHS covers. And eventually I was there so much, they just figured they better give me a job. So they broke down and hired me. And that's when something really incredible happened. Like, movies took over my life during that period. I was, you know, they were free rentals as an employee, so I was watching 3 or 4 movies a night, no exaggeration, and not a lot of time left for that great American novel. And the owners of Video American announced one day, like, hey, we're going to send you and a coworker to Toronto Film Festival as a bonus, which... this was like a new concept to me, like film festival. I knew I loved movies, but I'd never been to a major international festival. So, but we're going to be there just for 48 hours. So, you know, it was a meager video store budget. So my coworker and I really looked at the schedule and planned out, like, you know, how are we going to make this work for 48 hours? And what we found was the most movies you could watch in a day was 6. And this is if you started at 9 a.m. and watched continuously through the midnight movie. Maybe you could catch a, you know, dollar slice of pizza in a line somewhere or something. But this was our plan, and we executed the plan. We got out of day one. We got out of our movie around 2 o'clock in the morning and had seen 6. And walking back to our somewhat seedy hotel, we decided, let's just keep walking and talk about the movies a little bit because we're really abuzz with what we'd seen. And before too long, the sun came out. We'd been walking and talking all night, no sleep, and it was time to line up and watch 6 more. So that was my first film festival experience, 12 movies in 48 hours, a lot of delirium. And I came back to Baltimore kind of a changed person, but there are two things about that trip to Toronto, other than the 48-hour spree, that really stick in my mind and have informed my work. One was how awesome it was having the filmmakers there presenting their films. It didn't matter if it was, you know, an unknown or if it was an icon like Werner Herzog. The value and experience it added to have them there sharing their experience making the film was something I never knew that I wanted, but it really just changed my life. And the other thing, and this has really changed about Toronto Film Festival, but at the time, it was a very accessible film festival. The movies weren't quite selling out. Now it's a very red carpety, celebrity-driven thing. But back then, tickets were like $10 Canadian, which this was pre-9/11, so that's like 75 cents or something. Like, not a lot of money, you know? So it was really easy to get into these movies. And that stuck with me, too, that like there shouldn't be a big barrier for entry to get into these movies. So when I got back to Baltimore, instantly started doing some film festival and film-related stuff. There was an underground festival here called Micro Cinefest. Skiz Cizik, who's an absolute legend, ran that, and I volunteered for him there. I started a 16mm film series, underground stuff, at the Red Room at Normal Books and Records. And I had already been writing music reviews, but I switched over and went really hard on writing movie reviews, interviews with directors, and that sort of stuff for City Paper. So a couple years of doing that for City Paper, and you know, maybe overconfidently walked into the BMA and convinced a curator there to let me fire up the 35mm projectors that had been, you know, asleep for a long time and do a free-to-the-public foreign film series at the BMA. So, you know, this is maybe around 2005, 2006. There was no plan, but there was passion, and I was just doing things that interested me. And yet, in 2007, when a job opened up at the Maryland Film Festival programming team, to my surprise, and to no one's surprise more than mine, I was qualified, and I got the job. So I was a film programmer, and I had to learn, you know, what that meant as a living. And this is 2007. I ended up staying there for a little while, 11 years. And those 11 years, without implying causation, were really transformative years for film culture. There were a lot of young names who were coming up, and I was there supporting the early work by people like Greta Gerwig and Barry Jenkins and the Safdie brothers, who are now making, you know, really big movies and a big part of the industry. But 11 years is 11 years, and I really burned out on the gig at Maryland Film Festival, left that in 2018. And I didn't leave the film festival world, however. I started a consulting business where I was helping young filmmakers navigate the labyrinth that is festival applications, best practices for sending your film places, what festivals are and are not worth submitting to, where to try to get a premiere, these sort of things. And it was good. But in about 2022, a strange piece of news came across my desk, which was that year, my old organization, Maryland Film Festival, was not going to have an event. And I didn't think too much about it. I was trying to look forward, not backward. But a couple days later, I got a phone call out of the blue from Sam Sessa at WTMD. And yeah, let's hear it for Sam. And Sam had got my contact from our mutual friend Dan Deacon, the musician, and Sam had a question for me, which is, Eric, how much work and how much money would it really take to put on a film festival in Baltimore in 2023? Can't we do something to make sure that the city doesn't go without a film festival next year? And for me, that was a real, just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in moment. Because that conversation led to what became the first New Next Film Festival. Originally just conceived as a one-off so that Baltimore did have a worthy film festival in 2023. But on, you know, pretty scant resources, especially very short notice, we put together something that felt really special and was actually one of the best festival experiences I've been involved on professionally. So we decided to push to try to make it happen a second year, and it did. And that went even better. I was pinching myself after year two. And now I find myself again, you know, with that job that sounds like a kid made it up, because year-round, I'm the movie guy now, watching movies and getting paid to do it, a little bit, anyway. And yeah, so here we are as an audience, February into March. I'm the movie guy. A lot of people ask me about the Oscars and who I'm rooting for, and it may surprise you, and usually surprises them when they ask the question, that I don't even watch the Oscars. Like, the Oscars, you know, and no offense to those who do, but from where I'm sitting, every once in a while, there's a film like Barry Jenkins' Moonlight that really moves me and embodies what I love about independent cinema that also goes on to score at the Oscars. But more often, the Oscars to me feel like following the remainder of a baseball season when the Orioles have been eliminated months ago, and there's these like big money, big Titan teams probably taking steroids who are, you know, up for a title that no longer interests me too much. So I guess, and also to extend the metaphor, my job and the job of curators like me is to scout talent from all over the world that is ready to get called up to the major leagues, which I guess is my way of saying, if you love the Orioles, you'll come to New Next Film Festival October 1st through 4th. Thank you for your time. Yeah.
So that was Eric's story. His reveal of his T-shirt was he was wearing an Orioles T-shirt, right? Is that what it was?
Yeah, that was his great profound metaphor at the end.
Yeah.
That the New Next Film Festival is like the Orioles. Other people may be going to the multiplex and seeing the big blockbusters. Other people may be concerned about who's in the World Series. Here in Baltimore, we keep it real. We love the Orioles. And we go to the New Next Film Festival.
Oh, yeah. So I'm asking this because I was backstage, and so I wasn't able to see that part. So anyway, thank you so much for listening to another episode of the Stoop Storytelling Series podcast. We want to thank Baltimore Public Media for housing the podcast. We want to thank Maureen Harvey for being so patient in her production of the podcast. We want to thank you for listening to the podcast. If you want to hear more about The Stoop, upcoming events, and ways to submit your own story, you can go to Stoop.storytelling.com. See you next time.